session of 10481 Rule 3.
Chief Marshal Cross, Rule 3.
Demolishing the gangway, I've just come up, and the third shell of the salvo hit the deck about 10 yards in front of me, making a large hole, but it didn't explode. The full seriousness of the situation was then apparent to me, and I went forward to the bridge, and this was confirmed by the tenseness of the faces of the people on the bridge there, and it was plain to me that I would be in the way, so I went back across the flight deck to the gangway on the port side, on the other side, and down, and went back to my abandoned ship station on the quarter deck. The ship was then hit by a number of salvos, and the intercommunication system failed, so that the only information we had from the bridge on the quarter deck was by a runner or messenger. And from the next half an hour, 40 minutes, the ship was steadily hit by salvos. One of the first salvos, after I had left the flight deck, hit the island where the bridge was, and we understood killed the captain, because we were told that the ship was now under the command of the commander. And after about an hour, or perhaps a little less, the ship began to list very badly. We were still doing quite a good forward speed, some 12, 15 knots, but began to list badly, and we were zigzagging. And I thought that she would roll over, she had such a list on. And then eventually the order was given to abandon ship. And Carly floats were thrown over the side for the crew and us passengers to swim to when we'd jumped over the side. I asked a naval pilot who I'd got to know quite well in our trip out, Ginger Marmont, what was the form on a banding ship, and he said, well, as you see, when they drop these floats, we're still doing quite a considerable speed, and when they drop a float, you want to go pretty quickly afterwards, otherwise you will have a very long way to swim. So when they dropped a float from the quarterdeck, I had my Mae West on, I went over the side, came up like a cork, swam about 10 yards, and scrambled aboard the Carly float. Very soon we had 20 or 30 people in the ship, and to my great delight, Flight Lieutenant Jameson, my number two in the squadron, came swimming along and scrambled aboard the Carly float with me, and we sat side by side. And eventually the Glorious came to a halt about half a mile away from us, and one moment she was there, and then we looked round again, she had gone. Then the two German battleships came up. I didn't know at that time that they were the Scharnhorst and the Neisenau, but that's what they were. And reluctantly, I took these papers which I had got in my pocket about the squadron's operations in Norway. I took them out and threw them in the water because I was quite sure that we were going to be picked up by the Germans, and I was not going to give them any information about our operation. However, the two ships steamed up, did not stop, and went straight on, and within a quarter of an hour we were alone, 40 miles inside the Arctic Circle and about 200 miles off Norway. It was rough and very cold, and within a short time some of the sailors began to die. Within 3 hours the first died, and we had between 20 and 30 aboard our float, but within a few hours there were only 7 of us left. And
they were just dying of exposure, were they?
Yes. It was extraordinary, really, of those who survived, because one was a Marine who was wounded, and he survived. One was an old warrant officer of considerable age, and he survived, and some of the youngest did not survive. It was wet and it was cold, but I, of course, had an Irvin jacket, but Jameson had got nothing but a tunic and a roll neck pullover on him. You must remember that it was light the whole time, there was high cloud, no sun, and we had no idea of the passage of time. But some hours later, the numbers, people stopped dying in the thing, and we were left with 7 in the Carly float. And the sea went down, and I suppose by next morning or 12 hours later, we had no idea of knowing, the sea became absolutely calm. And so then we were there. We had nothing to eat, nothing to drink. And I said to Jameson, "And how long do you think we can stick this, Pat?" And he's a New Zealander, particularly tough New Zealander, and he knew a lot about survival. And he said, I think about 6 days. So the fact that we lost a great many people in 6 hours didn't shake Jameson's view at all. So we just sat there, and we always had one person on watch out of the 7, and we decided, I suggested, and the others agreed with me, that it would be a good idea if we could cut the oval grating in the centre of the Carly float. A Carly float's a sort of, like the an amphibian float. We cut the grating out of the bottom and put it long ways across the narrow part of the float, and that would mean that we could keep our feet out of the water, because up to then we were sitting on the Carly float with our feet in the water, and this was very uncomfortable. And Jameson had a pocket knife, and in turns we took hours to cut the rope all around this grating, till eventually we had the grating free, and then we took it out and slew it down, put it on the crossways on the Carly float. We put four on one side and three on the other side, and we were able to keep our feet out of the water. And we passed most of the time by being asleep. Always was one on watch.
Were there any other floats in the vicinity?
At the start, there were hundreds. But for the next morning, there wasn't a sign of anything at all. They all got scattered. Of course, we were quite confident that at any time now, the British fleet would come over the horizon, and we would be picked up. What we didn't know was that nobody had received the message from the Glorious when she was attacked, except one cruiser who didn't pass it on, and in fact. For some time, until the Germans announced it, nobody knew what had happened to the Glorious. Eventually, somebody said, "There's a ship," and there, sure enough, away 10 or so miles away was this ship, and. It was an agonizing business watching it. We could see its masts. When its masts were in line, they were coming towards us. And when they got out of line, we didn't know. And eventually, it came on. And this was a little Norwegian tramp steamer, the SS Borgund, running away from Harstad and making for the Faroe Islands. And they had come right through the area of the Carly floats, which had been dropped by the Glorious. And they picked up one or two here, one or two there, and eventually on this little ship, they had a total of 37 people. I should have said that we were escorted by two destroyers, the Ardent and the Castor, who were both sunk by the Sharnos and Eisenhower in the preliminary stages of the battle. And so out of the three crews of some over 1,500 men, the 37 in the Borgund were all that were saved. Our lot were about the last float to be picked up, and by the time we got in on this little ship, nearly every space had been occupied by semi-invalid survivors, and Jameson and I found ourselves in the engine room, where I was put on the steel bench with a vice in the middle of my back, and Jameson was put on the grill above the big end of the engine. We both agreed they were the most comfortable beds that we'd ever laid on. There was a splendid old Norwegian engineer who understood the situation very well. We were absolutely parched with thirst, and we asked him for a drink, and he gave us a drink out of a little mug of which he never filled more than quarter foot full, which meant that you had about three sips only. And then he would give you no more, three sips. And then 20 minutes later, you could have three more sips. And this was very sensible, because some of the people who drank more than they should have done had very great problems with their stomachs later on. Eventually, when I was a bit better, I was moved up on deck, and the captain told us, the Norwegian captain told us that we had been reconnoitred by a German aircraft, and we should be expect to be attacked at any time. But in fact, we weren't. I don't think the Germans. It was only 500 tons, this ship, and I don't think the Germans thought it was worthwhile. And eventually we reached the Faroe Islands and were taken off on stretchers by a British Army contingent, which was defending the place, to the local civilian hospital. By this time, we realized that our legs up to our knees had been afflicted with, I can only describe as, a mixture of frostbite and trench feet, and they hurt more and more every day.
And they become discolored?
No. Slightly blue, yes, slightly bluer, but not. They were swollen, but not badly discolored. There was nothing much they could do for us in this little hospital, and we were there for 2 or 3 days. And unfortunately, the old warrant officer had been on our float. Died there, and then we were told that we were to be taken back to Rosyth by a British destroyer who was escorting a little convoy of Norwegian ships, all of which had run away from Norway and gathered at the Faroes. So we were taken aboard the destroyer Veteran, commanded by a legendary naval officer by the name of Jackie Broom, who was pre-war was a great caricaturist, and we went slowly down from the Faroes to Rosyth, and then when we were getting near there, we were told we were going to Glen Eagles. I knew of Glen Eagles from golfing days, of being a 4-star or 5-star hotel, and we were immensely encouraged by this news. We thought we were going to have a wonderful time at this hotel, but when we got there, we found it had been turned into a Army General Hospital, and we were one of several hundred patients in the hospital, and we were there then the whole of the rest of June, July, and part of August.
Did you make a full recovery?
Much later. We eventually left Glen Eagles in mid-August. We could, with sticks, we could walk. But our feet were still very much enlarged, soft carpet slippers. And we went down by train to back to Digby, where we'd started from. Sadly, and then the doctors sent us off on sick leave, and I went back to my home at Hayling Island near Portsmouth, arriving there in the middle of August.
Could I just go back to the sinking of the Glorious? What was the atmosphere like on board the ship? Were things well organised during the attack, or was it chaotic?
It was absolutely splendid. There was absolutely no sign of panic from the beginning to the end. And when the intercommunication system failed, which might have led to some disorder or... It was quickly picked up by the messenger system, and I saw no sign of panic or indiscipline of any sort during the whole of the action. I got the greatest admiration for the naval crew and the way they behaved during the action.
When you went into the water, was there oil about?
No.
Did you, at any stage whilst you were on the Carly float, think that you might not be picked up, or did you have faith in being rescued?
I always was sure that we would be rescued. And I believe that may have helped me survive. Because I just believed that we had to wait until we were picked up. It never crossed my mind that we wouldn't be picked up. I don't know why that should be, but that was my view.
When you destroyed the papers, did you also destroy the squadron's money?
No, I didn't. And when I got, I didn't the. I don't, that was in an envelope in a different pocket. The squadron papers, in fact, were in a file inside my Irving jacket, and I threw them in the water so that the Germans couldn't get them. When I was in Gleneagles Hospital, I counted this money and found that it was some £200, which was a very considerable sum in those days. And I said, I wrote to the CO, who had taken over, reformed my squadron at Digby, and said, I got this money and I proposed to send it to him. And he said, he wrote back and said, oh, they didn't want it, they had everything they wanted. Why didn't I keep it and spend it on a party? So I did not think this was correct. And so I wrote to, when I was better, from Gleneagles, I wrote to Fighter Command and said I had got the balance of the money which had been given me to buy Fighter Command in case I needed it during the expedition. And I think I had, when I say £200, I think I had about £192 out of the £200, because we'd been able to spend a little bit on buying salmon and things from the local people up at Bar de Fosse to augment the rations. So I sent the £192 back to Fighter Command, and Fighter Command wrote back to me and wanted to know what had happened to the other eight.
When the Scharnhorst and Neisenauer passed you, was there any reaction from the German crew?
I couldn't see them.
So they weren't lining the rails?
Oh, no. No, they were at action stations. And what we didn't know, of course, was that one of the escorting destroyers, either the Ardent or a Castor, had fired a torpedo which had hit one of these ships. And therefore, all they were interested in was making harbour as quickly as they could, so they didn't stop at all, they didn't pick anybody up.